I'm Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. On today's show, I'll talk to Dewey Cassell and Aaron Sultan, co-authors of a new comic book artist biography, The Incredible Herb Trimpe. Stick around. Trimpe is best known for his 8-year run as artist on The Incredible Hulk, and I just know you want to know what happened when he got angry. In the introduction to the biography, The Incredible Herb Trimpe, former Marvel Comics editor Tom DeFalco sums up artist Trimpe's unusually long run as the artist on The Incredible Hulk just perfectly. This is what he said. He somehow conveyed the power of Kirby with the stylization of Ditko, but added a humanity, a pathos that was all his own. Where Kirby's Hulk was an enraged monster with a hair-trigger temper, and Ditko's was a sinister and angry master planner, Herb's version was a desperate and haunted individual, someone who had been misused and abused, yet struggled to control his explosive tantrums. To that, I might add that Trimpe's Hulk, aided and abetted by writers Roy Thomas and Len Wein, was a bridge to the modern Hulk found in the popular Avengers movies, in which he's portrayed by Mark Ruffalo, or even the 1970s TV version brought to life by Lou Ferrigno, and less so the Eric Bana and Edward Norton editions, at least in my opinion. In the new Tomorrow's biography of Trimpe, co-authored by Dewey Cassell and Aaron Sultan, Q&As with Trimpe, who died suddenly shortly before the well-illustrated book was published, as well as Q&As with many of his admirers and collaborators, bring the man and his work to life. A quiet man, Trimpe nonetheless was a Vietnam War veteran who always brought believability to his battle scenes, whether starring the Emerald Giant, Nick Fury in S.H.I.E.L.D., Kid Colt and the Two-Gun Kid, or licensed characters such as G.I. Joe, Godzilla, and Transformers. He was also the very first artist to draw Wolverine, although the character's significance may not have immediately been apparent to anyone at Marvel. Now, if you love the Hulk, you'll enjoy learning more about one of his modern fathers, Herb Trimpe. Dewey Cassell and Aaron Sultan, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Guys, let's go right for the red meat. Well, actually, I guess it's green meat. Was Incredible Hulk number 165, I think it was, possibly the dumbest ever handled by Mr. Trimpe? I mean, come on. This is the mind-bending menace of Aquan, the murderous fish man.
It was probably close, although, to be honest, Trimpe's personal favorite in terms of the worst villain ever was the one called Zax.
Zax?
He didn't have any use for that one at all.
What was Zax? I don't remember that one at all.
Sort of a lightning kind of creature who appeared, I think, in one of the later issues.
Hmm. Yeah, there were, you know, the Hulk always had some great villains and some really horrible, horrible villains. You could just kind of tell that there were months that went by when somebody just didn't know what to do with him.
Well, I think you're right. I think one of the challenges is, you know, what do you do with a character who is so strong that he's almost invulnerable?
And I picked on Aquan, the murderous fishman, only because he was so visible in the book. There's a full page devoted to that cover, and I went, oh my God, this is the worst. I don't even remember this from childhood, and I was a teenager when that came out. And I read all the books, and I just looked at that and went, oh my God, I just want to gag. It was just horrible. Anyway, so I had to get that out of my system. And I think, Dewey, you wanted to explain how you knew how to pronounce Herb's last name correctly?
Well, Herb just, told us in the course of the interviews that if anybody had any uncertainty about how to pronounce his name, that it rhymes with Shrimpy.
Kind of like Wolverine.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. So, sorry, I can't help myself. Aaron, what led you guys to do a book on Herb?
We go back, Dewey and I have a 25 to 30 year friendship and have always shared this interest with comics. And, starting in the early 90s, we started attending some conventions together. That led us to meeting George and Dorothy Tuska, another one of the Marvel legends and Silver Age, Golden Age great. Dewey wrote a book on George, and I assisted him with some of that about a dozen years ago, also with Tomorrow's. And from there, fast forward to about 4 or 5 years ago, Dewey once again did another book on Marie Severin, the first woman in comics. And These were people that it wasn't just picking artists out of the blue. These are people that were just very genuine people that we really got to know and enjoy, talk on the phone. Dewey and I have both been to George's house, Tuska, when he was alive, and spent some time with he and his wonderful wife, Dorothy. And similarly with Marie Severin, we've both been visited Marie and just enjoyed her company. She's just very down to earth and a wonderful person to be around, and very humble. There's a thread, I think, with all of these, George, Tuska, Marie Severin, Herb Trimpe. They're all very humble people. And we've certainly enjoyed just enjoying company with them. And I think it was Dewey's idea once again, about 3 years ago or so, to do a book with Herb. And he proposed that to Tomorrow's. They accepted. And we've just thoroughly enjoyed pursuing that. And Herb has, as you said at the very beginning, a very able intro. He's had a very wealth of great characters. It just made a titanical contribution to the Marvel Universe.
Did you guys sense that there was a gap in our knowledge of a real principle in the Marvel Universe? We can ignore the phone. Don't worry about the phone. There's a lot of major figures who were involved in the 60s in Marvel and the 70s when they were really changing things and everything was evolving so dramatically in the comics business. What made you think that there was a story to be told with Herb, though?
Well, I think Herb had a tremendous amount of influence on comics, particularly because he worked in the Marvel offices. You know, there were a lot of guys that worked for Marvel over the years, but very few of them that actually worked in the office. John Romita, Marie Severin, and Trimpe, and then the guys like Saul Brodsky that did production and that kind of stuff. But, you know, he was one of the few guys that was there on staff, for almost 30 years. And, he was willing to take on assignments other people weren't. And as a result of that, he ended up really touching an awful lot of different characters, not just superheroes, over the course of his career.
And we should mention, I mentioned some in the introduction, some of the Marvel characters. He was the first to draw Wolverine. He did 8 years on the Hulk. He did Two Gun Kid, and he did Westerns. He did Transformers, G.I. Joe, and... what's the other one that I'm missing, the licensed character?
Shogun Warriors.
Oh, okay. Transformers. What else did he do? Tell folks, give him kind of the broad strokes of some of the other characters that he worked on that he's kind of known for.
Well, if you think of almost every major character in the Marvel Universe, pick Spider-Man. He was a Marvel team-up artist. He had a run on Iron Man. If you look at the popular characters in the movies today, Herb Trimpe touched them and did a major contribution to them. He also was involved with Ant-Man. That's a little fact that a lot of people didn't know. And if we were doing this interview a year ago, that wouldn't have been a big deal. But now it's a huge deal. He had a great Bronze Age run on Ant-Man. The Hulk is obviously his memorable run. And then contributions to the X-Men. You mentioned Wolverine. The licensed characters, and then if you go back and just do a search on Herb Trimpe, you will probably find him penciling pretty much everybody in the Marvel Universe. I'm sure he did touches on Luke Cage, Power Man for a time, or
Son of Satan,
Silver Surfer. Yeah, the list just goes on and on.
Oh, I didn't realize he worked on Surfer. I knew about Son of Satan, and I guess I knew about Luke Cage, but Silver Surfer, when was that? 60s? 70s?
It was during the original run on the Silver Surfer, mm-hmm. right?
Yes, it was. He was an inker, if my memory serves me correctly, with Jack Kirby on the 1960s run. I know for a fact that he at least did issue 18, the very last and only issue that Kirby had done.
I knew that.
We knew that. He also did a lot of collaborating. People think of Hulk and taking over on that run fairly early after Marie Severin had started it with issue 102, which was a continuation of Tales to Astonish. If you may recall, the Tales to Astonish series ended with issue 101, and they picked right up with issue 102 with the Hulk. And Marie and George Tuska collaborated on some of those early issues along with Herb before Herb took over there shortly thereafter. But Herb also collaborated and was around on the Tales to Astonish days as well.
Tales to Astonish, was that split with Submariner or?
Yes.
Submariner, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, once again, just trying to put in that I actually have read comic books. I knew that Silver Surfer, the original run, was only 18 issues. I was waiting for an opportunity to stick that in, but you got to
it. I beat you to the punch.
Yes, you did. All right, so let's before we go much further with his with him and the characters themselves. This was a guy who, in the 60s, before he got to Marvel, faced the dilemma that a lot of young men did then. Do I enlist? Do I wait till I'm drafted? He figured if he was drafted, he'd have to do 2 years in the Army and go straight to Vietnam. He decided to enlist and outsmart them and do 4 years with the Air Force, but he wound up in Vietnam for a year or two nonetheless, right? Was it unusual in the late 60s for a Vietnam vet to find his way into comics? And I'm asking that particularly at Marvel, which was extremely countercultural at the time. It wasn't, you know, I mean, it's not like Stan Lee was a hippie, but he was working so hard to relate to the kids and to crack that market. I'm thinking that Marvel, as opposed to DC especially, would have been an odd place for a Vietnam vet to find himself.
You know, and I think to some extent you're right. I don't know, you know, for certain how many other vets may have served with Marvel, but I do know that, you know, at the time there was sort of an anti-war feeling that pervaded the comics too. You know, if you were reading war comics at that time, a lot of them sort of cast a tone that was anti-war. And while I wouldn't say that Herb was pro-war, Herb did not mind serving. And actually, you know, there's a documentary that we saw of Herb from 1970 that shows the old Marvel offices, and hanging above Herb, above his desk, is a picture of General Patton. You know, so he was definitely you know, appreciated the opportunity to serve, and I think was proud of his service. And I think it was unusual.
But see, I saw that mentioned in the book, and I just assumed that he had that not because he idolized Patton, but because of General. What's the general in the Hulk who's always coming after?
Thunderbolt Ross.
I assume that that's why he had General Patton there, because he was modeling him after Patton. No?
Well, I suspect it was some of both.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe a little stretch on that one, but yeah.
All right. Did you get the sense that he was particularly, you know, pro-military? I don't know. I don't know how you would get that sense in the comic books. I mean, Chuck Dixon, you can tell he's very aggressively pro-gun, pro-military. He's a very conservative guy. For a guy who served 4 years in the military, you guys spent time with him. Did you get any sense that pervaded his life later on, or was that just part of his past?
Well, I do think that he was certainly proud of his service, and I think that came through in the authenticity of the drawing that he did whenever he did anything that was military-related, or Westerns, as you pointed out, or whatever. You know, he had a great run on G.I. Joe, and I think he brought to that an appreciation for the military. So, I don't think he was a gun fanatic. I never heard him talk about that, but he certainly was proud, I think, of his service and appreciated the military.
So you guys never sat at a table and played Russian roulette with him?
No.
Nor flew in a plane with him.
Okay. Now, speaking of G.I. Joe, though, I got to ask you. There's a great story about how when he was working on G.I. Joe, was it Hasbro? Is that the manufacturer?
Uh-huh.
They sent him models, prototypes of the toys, and well, you can tell the story. What happened?
Well, I mean, I think if he, you know, they kept the toys. I mean, they were able to play with the toys. He gave the toys to the kids. But, you know, he and Larry Hama did the design work on a lot of those early small version G.I. Joes. And Larry Hama in particular, you know, was a big proponent of turning the comics into toys for Hasbro. and vice versa. And Hasbro gave him a tremendous amount of leeway in terms of what he could do. And Trimpy was one of the primary ones illustrating it at the time.
Well, maybe I didn't ask the question very well. What I'm thinking about is in the book, you talk about how when he was working on it, he wanted to be so realistic that he created a model of Cobra Island. Is that it? Right. And they had sent him prototype toys to work with, and they got destroyed pretty much, right? And so he felt so bad that he gave them his model of Cobra Island just to kind of make up for destroying their toys. And am I telling that story correctly?
I think you've got it right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I was trying to set you up to tell the story, but I.
You did a great job.
I went too far. Okay. All right. Tell folks what sets, as an artist, what sets Herb apart from others in his generation? Is it the line where, you know, we can, and I don't know how, I'm not particularly well versed in being able to describe, you know, one artist's line from another, you know, whether the boldness of the lines. I can't tell you what type of pen they used, but, you know, you've spent so much time writing about him and studying him. Do you have a sense of what distinguishes him from others in his generation?
Well, I think one of the things that came out loud and clear when we were doing the interviews is there was a theme, whether it was from Joe Sinnott or Marie Severin or some of the other people we talked to, that Herb, I think most people would agree, you know, was not a Jack Kirby, nor are most people a Jack Kirby. But the thing that set him apart in his generation was, and this was the theme coming from his peers, is that he was a master storyteller. They said that he could be given a plot and he could just create the story. The Marvel method was all about the artist sitting down and drawing out the story and then the writer filling in the dialogue, and he was a master at that. So I'm not sure that that his art would necessarily be distinguished against somebody like a Jack Kirby or a John Romita, but the storytelling capability, as evidenced by what he could do with the Hulk and turn out some issues that, as you said, had some just, you know, horrific villains, whether good or bad horrific, he was just able to really communicate that storyline.
It's interesting to me. I did an interview. Oh, I can't think of the fella's name all of a sudden. He did a book for Tomorrow's on Don Heck.
Yeah, John Coates.
John Coates, a very nice guy. Let's not take anything away from John. Wrote a good book. But I got a little crap because I felt like Heck was kind of the blandest. To my eyes, his work was some of the blandest work of the Marvel 60s era. And but I look at Trimpy, and yeah, he's not stylish the way a Steranko or a Ditko or a Kirby is, but you know his work when you see it. There's something to it. You talk about, I guess, Romita. There's an interview with Romita talking about how they wanted the Wolverine, when he was first appeared in the Hulk, to be 5'4", 5'5", kind of squat. But it always seemed to me that Herb Trimpe's Hulk was also kind of squat. He didn't build him. He didn't draw him to be like a skyscraper. You know, he was always broad-shouldered, big, muscular arms and legs, but he wasn't. He never struck me as being. You know, I felt like I could look him in the eye. He'd destroy me. He'd pulverize me. But that was one of the things I always thought was kind of distinctive about Trimpy's work, is that type of thing.
Yeah, I think that, and I think one of the to build on that, I think he could really communicate just destruction and action with such a figure. Some of my favorite moments reading the Hulk and looking at Herb's artwork are when you see the Hulk slamming his fist into the ground and pieces flying everywhere, or a beautiful piece he did for Dewey several years ago that I remember Herb doing for him was the Hulk slamming his hands together like a big clap that was creating this sonic boom. And just rippling these sound waves and knocking over buildings that were in its way. So that's kind of how I would characterize that.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, one of the things that Herb used to talk about was the fact that he also made no effort to make the Hulk attractive. You know, the Murray Severance Hulk actually was kind of a pretty nice looking guy. But Trimpe felt like that if you had to go through that kind of a painful transformation, that it would manifest itself in that you would not be a terribly attractive. You would have crooked teeth, you know, and it would affect you in that way. And that's the way he drew him. And to your point earlier, I think that's what people related to as well.
Now, you guys, I'm assuming, had access to, or at least got to see a lot more original art of Herb's than most people do. What kind of things did you notice in the, you know, the black and white, in the originals, that might not be apparent to us in the finished work?
Well, I would just say, you know, just like in most originals, you get to see detail that you didn't see come out in the final product, in the colored pages that are, you know, 8.5 by 11 or whatever size they have diminished to. You know, that was something that was very evident there. Just seeing some of the swipes, some of the action scenes, maybe even seeing some of the facial expressions, for example, on, you know, the love interest, Thunderbolt Ross, the other characters in there, you would see some expressions and some line work that you may not see in the finished product or in the final comic pages.
Did you come to any conclusion about who inked him best?
You have an opinion on that, I believe, don't you?
I'm sorry, I missed the question.
Who inked him best?
Oh, well, I think John Severin, you know, and I think you'd agree, wouldn't
yes,
you?
Yes, I would.
Yeah, I mean, and Trimpe felt the same way. I mean, that period of time in which he and Severin were working together on the Hulk was just magical, you know, and Severin, when Severin inked someone else's pencils, he had a tendency to impose a little of his own style on there. But with Trimpe, it just worked beautifully well. Trimpe's composition was just wonderful. And then to see that inking, the tremendous detail that John Severin would put into it, I mean, the finished project was just it was just amazing.
Yeah.
And what did you find in your research and in the interviews you did about the way Herb was perceived by the industry?
I think he was perceived very favorably, you know, by the industry. As Aaron said, you know, his peers certainly felt very strongly that he was not only an exceptional storyteller, and he'd be the first to tell you that he wasn't the world's greatest artist, but he was a great storyteller, and he was very well respected by his peers and fans. As we mentioned in the book, you know, there was a guy who did a documentary about him called Herb Trimpe, We Love You, in 1970, and you know, I mean, I think that was sort of the way people felt about him, really, no matter what he was working on. You know, that's the interesting part about talking to the fans, is you'll find the fans that, oh, they could take or leave the Hulk, but they just absolutely loved what he did on Shogun Warriors, you know, or they're just diehard G.I. Joe fans, or they're, you know, he had a way to appealing to a lot of different kinds of people and lots of different genres.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Aaron.
Yeah, no, I would just add to that. He really did have that appeal, and I think if you look back on Milestones, you know, kind of like what Gil Kane was with certain Spider-Man issues, Herb Trimpe was in the right place at the right time, in a critical period of the Hulk's launching and becoming a, you know, something from, you know, something that was rarely seen only on the comic racks in 1968 to in 1972, the merchandising along with Spider-Man and maybe a little bit of Iron Man, but clearly Spider-Man and the Hulk were the two Marvel merchandising leads, the moneymakers, if you will, through the 1970s. And then when you layer onto that Wolverine coming along and being in that, you know, pivotal position, you know, creating probably the most popular character since Spider-Man that Marvel's had, and arguably, you know, its most popular character ever. And here's Herb drawing the cover and drawing the interiors of the very first issue, the cameo in the issue before, the follow-on, it's just amazing what the imprint he left on the comics world.
I hadn't thought to ask you this before, but did Marvel ever take care of him once Wolverine started appearing in all the movies? Did he ever get any taste of that?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Oh, that's awful. I mean, I you know, I know that the artists and the writers have been screwed over repeatedly by this, and only those that have made a lot of noise, of course, have been have gotten any remuneration. But holy cow, I mean, he was right there at the beginning of Wolverine.
As you know, his parting with Marvel was not entirely pleasant, and I think, some of that just carried forward, unfortunately. He did get all the original art back and that kind of thing that the other artists did, mm-hmm. And was able to benefit from that in later years, by going to conventions and selling it. But in terms of royalties, I'm not aware of him having gotten anything off the movies.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Did he was it a point of pride for him that he was there at Wolverine's birth? I mean, he may not have felt it at the time that it happened, but over time, as the character grew and grew, was that something he took pride in, or it was just another piece of the past?
Well, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he would say at the time that he did it, he had no idea, that there might be anything to come of it. But when he talked about creating Wolverine, he was very careful to give credit to all of the people that were involved. He was the guy who first drew the finished product, but John Romita is the one who did the original design, and Roy Thomas is really one that started the idea about a Canadian superhero. And so he was Len Wein played a part in it as well. So he was very quick to point out the fact that it was a collaborative effort, and he just happened to be fortunate enough to be the guy who did the drawing on those first appearances.
Okay. Yeah, he was, when we would see him at shows and our interaction with him, you'll see some creators that have giant backdrops and, I'm the creator of X, Y, and Z. And it's great. There's been wonderful creators out there that have done characters then and done characters now. Herb just kind of showed up at these shows. He, walked in. And again, the theme of the people that we tend to be attracted to are the ones that have that humility characteristic. And that certainly, I think, would describe Herb. He would show up, he would open up a dusty portfolio, pull out some things for sale. People would come up and just gush over creating the Wolverine or, their favorite issue when they were 11 years old and sit in the summertime, all the sentimental stories, he's heard them all. But he would just, he would enjoy that, and he would be very glad that it touched people, but you never seemed to think that he would feel the need to go around and say, here's what I created, the Wolverine. That just wasn't his style.
I did a lot of comic book shows this past year, and it was fascinating to me, having been away from it for a while, to go and down Artist Alley. And you expect, okay, I'm going to see people I know or I know of who I recognize. But it seemed like those who had the biggest signs and the biggest posters were always the guys you knew absolutely nothing about. You didn't know their names. And the ones who just showed up and had their little table and had maybe a little tri-stand on the table, those were the ones who made you go, whoa, wow, look who I'm meeting, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I gather you enjoyed being around Herb. He was the kind of guy that, was nice to spend time with and, make small talk.
Very definitely. He's just a very approachable person, very warm and friendly and, more than – it's just great – not only great storyteller in terms of drawing, but just great storyteller in terms of telling stories. He loved to talk about, when his kids were growing up. One of his favorite things to do with his kids was to literally make games for them to play with. Hmm. It wasn't enough to use a board game that you bought at the store. He'd make his own game. And he had one where they had, I think it was airplanes that were involved in the game. And the airplanes had different heights that you could associate with them. It was almost like HeroClix or something, years earlier. And his son talked about how much fun it was growing up with a dad like Herb. And of course, once he learned how to fly and got the plane, then it was, that was even better because, the kids would talk about going to the fair and going on roller coasters. And he's saying, well, that's nothing. I went with my dad on an airplane.
Well, now, wait a minute. So these games that Trimpy would make, so if he found himself losing to his kids, is that when he would go, Herb, smash, and destroy the game? Any truth to
that? Don't know. I did hear some mention from his son that I think he occasionally changed the rules if it looked like he was losing. But
I was just making that up. I don't know. just a couple more things, and we'll let you get out of here. I love I think it was a Marie Severin sketch of the women fawning over him in the Marvel bullpen. Marie's right in front of his face, leaning backwards, and there's women just piled up around him. Did he have? I mean, you see the pictures. He apparently was a very handsome guy in his youth and and onward. Did he have any sense of that part of him? Or you spent time with his family? Did would his wife have said that? Yeah, he was a handsome fella.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he married Linda Feit, who was working there at Marvel. Linda was his second wife, and they were married for 33 years, I think. So, yeah, certainly there was an appreciation for the fact that he was – I mean, you mentioned Don Heck. Don't get me wrong. I love Don. I thought he was a terrific guy, and I actually liked him as an artist. But he tended to be like a lot of the other ones. They were older, and they were balding like I am and that kind of thing. And Herb was a young guy. He was tall, lanky, and I think Marie says the story happened exactly the way it was drawn. Herb says he doesn't remember it.
Right, I saw that. That was great. I liked that a lot. So, what did his? We're just about done here, but what did his cooperation bring you in terms of art or other memorabilia, souvenirs of his career that you might not have been able to access without him?
Well, I'm not sure that it necessarily brought us, anything unique. But I know one time he did. Matter of fact, Dewey was a recipient of that. He did a sketch for me. He was very accessible to talk to on the phone. We both, in terms of memorabilia, we both are fans of all the Marvel merchandise from the 60s or 70s. The convention programs and
the pop art cards.
The pop art cards, the letters, and all that stuff. So, he would certainly sign endlessly things for us. There was a time a year or so before he passed away where I sent him a nice little hefty stack of Hulk issues, which probably 20 or 30 copies that he graciously signed and sent back. So he was just always willing to fulfill whatever we were looking for.
And he did keep a lot of his stuff. Whereas a lot of he sold some of it as it went along, but he kept a tremendous amount of material, mm-hmm. Including old newspaper strips that he had drawn that were never published, pinups, like he had a pinup of Iron Man with the nose that I don't think was ever published, but it was a gorgeous pinup, that kind of thing, to where his willingness to hang on to that stuff through the years benefited us tremendously.
That's
in
true.
Terms of putting together the book.
Oh, very nice. And finally, Marvel let Herb go in 96, and you have excerpts from a New York Times story that he wrote about it, which was fascinating. What did he do? I know what the book says, but so I'm asking you a little rhetorically here. But what did he do for the next 20 years, or roughly 20 years, before he passed? How did he spend his working life?
Well, it was very frustrating to him when Marvel let him go, and so he decided to go back to school and wanted to teach, which was a wonderful idea, to be able to share what he knew and about drawing with kids. So he went back to school and then ended up teaching art and really I think found a real joy in being able to share everything he had learned with the kids. And he talked about one story where there was a kid who had drawn something in class and they were very unhappy with it. They felt like, oh, it just didn't turn out well at all. And they were just going to throw it away. And Herb said, oh, no, don't throw it away. He said, I'd like to hang on to it. So he took it home that night and inked the drawing that this person had done and brought it back in the next day and showed them. And he said, the kid just lit up. And so he found a real joy, I think, in being able to share what he knew about artwork with other people. And then of course, eventually, I think he felt the call to get back into comics. Certainly he was getting calls from conventions wanting him to come and attend. And that's when he started coming back to the shows.
Yeah, and I would throw in there one other thing that was a post-1996 situation. Was he had a very unique opportunity to serve as a chaplain for the aftermath of 9/11. He tells that story that is just astounding, where the church he was attending, I believe he was a deacon there or something like that, and he was called out to come and do a shift, essentially, as they were going through the rubble of the trade centers and to offer any kind of comfort and, you know, provide any kind of, you know, services that would be needed. And while he was there, I guess he dressed in black that day and they started calling him Father. And pretty soon he was thrust into praying for everybody. And there, he wrote this book that was based on those experiences, actually, that Dewey lent to me years before we were even, Herb was even on our radar for doing a book. He wrote a book called The Power of Angels, which it's, I highly recommend it. It's a great book to read. It's a quick read. And he describes that whole experience of being put into that situation. I think that he really drew a lot of spiritual strength from that period of time.
Great story. Thanks for adding that. Well, folks, listen, you can order Dewey Cassell and Aaron Sultan's illustrated biography, The Incredible Herb Trimpe. It's from Tomorrow's Books, wherever you typically get your books about comics, or you can order it right now at a great price from MrMedia.com. If you are watching the show on MRMedia.com, you probably know how this works. Somewhere below the video, either to the left or to the right, you'll see the cover of the book. Click on it, and you can have it delivered by drone from Amazon in 30 minutes or less. I don't know if that's actually true. It's just what I hear.
Maybe the Hulk will bring it.
Maybe the Hulk will bring it himself, or maybe a mailman with Hulk hands. If not that, then you can order it and have it within, you know, a day or two, whatever you want to pay for. It's also available as a digital download only from tomorrows.com, and that's T-W-O. Morrows.com. Guys, do you have is there a website supporting the book? Somewhere we can tell people to go look?
Not really, other than the Tomorrow's site. That's really your best shot.
All right. Either you guys on Twitter, Facebook, can people find you on social media?
We hide.
All right. This is some. Go ahead.
We are out on Comic Art Fans.
Yeah.
ComicArtFans.com. We're it's a website for galleries of original comic art, and Dewey and I are two of the thousands of people that are out there, but you can find us out there as well and connect with us.
Okay.
And see some Trimpe artwork.
And to boot.
Very good. Well, Dewey and Aaron, it was fascinating to read the book, and thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Media, today.
Thank you, Bob. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience full of famous, impossibly muscled men and women, from the Hulk and She-Hulk to Strong Guy and the Brute, in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. And so you guys did the biography. What's the authoritative pronunciation on Herb's last name?
Trimpe.
That's what I thought. That's the way I've always said it, going back 40 years, but, you know.
Well, as he said, it rhymes with Trimpe.
Maybe I'll ask you that.
That's a good opening line.
I have a worse one.